Hail Macbeth. Hail to thee, Thane of Glamis. All hail Macbeth. Hail to thee, Thane of Cawdor. All hail Macbeth, that shalt be king hereafter. Banquo and Macbeth, all hail.
Here's a spot.
Thou hast it now, as the weird woman promised. And I fear thou pleads most foully for it.
What is thy name?
Thou be afraid to hear it. My name's Macbeth.
There has been much talk in recent weeks about the RSC's production of Macbeth. But turn your glance to the silver screen and streaming platforms, and you'll find that Shakespeare's most abject analysis of greed, ambition, and lust for power is wowing select audiences around the UK. Directed by Kit Monkman and starring Mark Rowley as Macbeth, Akia Henry as Lady Macbeth, and Al Weaver as Banquo, this is a stunning movie that mixes the traditional approach with a rich visual language, a tapestry of vividly imagined locations presented as CGI set dressing for the story to unfold against. The movie's summary is as follows. Brilliant young General Macbeth pulls off a glorious victory in battle before returning to an indolent court where honours are dispensed by whim. Spurred on by prophesying drifters and an ambitious wife, Macbeth sets his sights on the throne. In Kit Monkman's adventurous new adaptation, this compelling tale of unchecked ambition, soured friendship, lost intimacy, and the descent into nihilism is encountered in a strange and claustrophobic territory, partly conjured by the mind. To find out more about the movie and its ambitious use of green screen, I spoke to the director, Kit Monkman.
One of the things that struck me, and a lot of things struck me, one of the first things that struck me was the casting.
Yep.
In Macbeth, it appeared. I mean, I watch a lot of films, although I do tend to veer more towards the blockbuster sort of thing these days because my wife's not so keen in on sort of fringe movies or art house or anything. Yeah. But I didn't recognize any of the actors, I don't think. So where did you find them?
Okay. We found them through traditional means, in a sense. I mean, there are a number of issues that played into that, I guess. One is, you know, as a kind of essentially a first-time director trying to make Shakespeare, you know, clearly you're going to scare away an awful lot of those bigger names whose reputations might be damaged if they were working with people that they just have no idea who they are. But there was also, more significantly, was that we wanted, from the story point of view, to play the Macbeths relatively young. Yeah, normally it's the kind of role that's taken on by the slightly kind of the middle-aged actor who's in his prime. And if you do that, then, you know, I think there's an audience. It's much harder to read their plotting and planning as anything other than political. You know, they're kind of knowing political beings. So whereas I think if you play them younger, there's a sort of sense that they're driven by adrenaline and fear and enthusiasm and all sorts of things that I think you can, as an audience, have a much more empathic relationship with them because of that. And that's something that we wanted. You know, we wanted to kind of to try to make them at best as kind of empathic and engaging as possible. I mean, clearly they're not entirely pleasant people, so that's, that's an impossible task to do completely. But, you know, but to at least try to bring the audience on side as much as possible. And that also plays, I guess, into Macbeth's relationship with Banquo. You know, Banquo is normally played as this kind of incredibly sort of straight bat. You know, he's a very solid, good man, and we wanted this sort of sense that actually, you know, on a day-to-day ethical level, Al Banco is probably more of a kind of, you know, a philanderer and a kind of a rule breaker than Macbeth, but obviously it has lines that he won't cross. And so by building up their relationship as a much more kind of laddish, youthful relationship, I think when it does break down, it becomes more poignant.
Okay. One of the things that is often levelled at Shakespeare is that it's not suitable for modern audiences, or it's too complicated, or it's too cerebral, or whatever. There is an angle to this which we'll come to in a moment or two, but you mentioned casting younger actors. So where is the audience for this movie? Is it schools? Is it Shakespeare aficionados? Is there a general audience for this, do you feel?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, the reason Shakespeare's still around after, you know, 400 years is that he has a kind of universality. You know, he speaks about what it is to be human. And there's, you know, once you get inside the language and able to sort of to engage with it, I think there are very few people he doesn't speak to, because we're all suffering the same sort of journeys. And, you know, he's a brilliant articulator of what that feels like, and he can take, you know, to places that you probably individually don't want to go to, as in the Macbeth. But even then, you know, there's kind of elements of their story which is absolutely universal to all of us, either directly or indirectly. And I think it's always about, you know, I mean, what filmmakers have always done with Shakespeare is, you know, is revisit him again and again with new cultural ideas, new technological ideas, because you know, it's the most engaging of territories. And, you know, I think you have to try to bring something new and fresh to it. And when you say, what's the audience? I mean, I think that, you know, the audience feels to me like, you know, it's as diverse as modern Britain. You know, the audience is us, all of us. And I think, you know, if you're going to try to make a film that plays to all of us, that isn't, you know, obviously if you're trying to set it in 11th century Scotland, then your hands are a bit tied.
Yeah.
But because we've theatricalized it and placed it in a kind of story space, it felt to me like, you know, it should be a story for everyone. And, you know, I hope that, you know, people doing their O-levels will engage with it. But equally, you know, we've had some incredibly serious academics, you know, who got incredibly excited about what it's trying to do. And, you know, it has all sorts of, you know, kind of meta meanings, in terms of, you know, it has a lot of kind of knowing nods towards previous Shakespearean productions and things that probably only academics, you know, or people who are well versed in their Shakespearean film history will reference.
Absolutely.
But none of those are intended to make it harder for somebody who's doing their O-levels to watch and engage. You know, so I hope it's like any good storytelling. It works on lots of different levels, and, you know, it's aimed at the broadest of possible audiences.
It is, in a way, I don't think any, I'm not wanting to be unkind to most of the modern Shakespeare, it is a visual treat in ways most others are not. There's obviously, as you kind of alluded to there, in terms of cinematic Shakespeare, there's a nod to Henry V, isn't there? In the expansion of the stage setting. But there's also the stage setting itself feels completely authentic, as if you're actually in the theatre watching it.
Yeah, well, absolutely, because, I mean, there's a number of things going on there, I think. First of all, you know, I've always had a slight problem with Shakespeare on film, simply because, you know, what it gives you is, you know, it explains where the environment is and it makes it look beautiful, but what it takes away is that Shakespeare didn't write naturalistic language in the 17th century, let alone now. You know, he's not writing as people spoke to each other. He's writing kind of theatrically and poetically. And you know, you get 12 burly men on a Scottish moor all hurling, you know, iambic pentameter at each other. And you start thinking there's something wrong here. At least I do, anyway. this isn't right. And whereas you put it on a blank stage, and where you're expected to kind of imagine as much as you are being told visually, you know, it becomes incredibly powerful and poetic and kind of inner. And so I think what we wanted to do was try to use, you know, some very modern technologies to try to recapture elements of exactly what you're saying, that sense of, you know, playing it on a theatrical stage. I mean, I don't know how obvious it is to you, but one of the things that we've done that's quite radical is that, you know, in the whole sort of two-hour film, really, there are hardly a couple right at the beginning, a couple right at the end, but apart from that, there are no over-the-shoulder shots or any of the kind of conventional film language of, you know, breaking up a scene, because we wanted the audience to feel like it had a position, just like you would in theatre. So
yeah, the scene with Macbeth and Lady Macbeth in bed together, that's an amazing piece of work, because it's an absolutely static scene, but the movement of the two actors, you don't notice that there's no other shots.
Yeah, and it's all one take. And actually, I'm pleased you mentioned that, because for all the kind of technical kind of, you know, trickery of the film, in a sense, the two scenes that I'm happiest with are that one and its complete mirror, which I don't know if you got that far, but at the end of the banquet with you know, Banquo's ghost, there's a mirror of that scene, which again is one take with just the two of them, you know, both, I think, you know, she's on the... What is she? She's on the left-hand side of the screen. He's on the right. Well, no, it's the other way around, isn't it? But they're both on the same side, you know, as they were in the previous. So it's a kind of... The scene you're talking about is you know, when the relationship's going well and they're desperately in love.
Sure.
And the other scene is the scene, moment when you absolutely know that the relationship's broken. And so they're a complete mirror of each other. They're both done in one take, both done using the same technique. And I think they kind of wrap up that relationship very kind of clearly. And I think that if somebody asked me that, you know, which bit of the film are you most proud of, I think it would actually, for all the kind of technical cleverness of the rest of it, it would be the most simple thing possible, which is just, you know, two shots.
In terms of the technical side of this movie, it is huge. We'll have the trailer accompanying this podcast, but for anyone who isn't quite aware, there is an amazing world created within the movie. There must have been a lot of green screen work here.
It's entirely green screen, really. I think. I mean, the only, apart from obviously the actors, the things that they physically hold, the only bit of real set is the little porter's lodge. In the play, there's a porter who kind of sits slightly outside of the rest of the film world, and you know, he's in a little space which feels, as I say, other, and that is actually a kind of tiny little set that was built, but everything else is generated in the computer. And as you say, I think, I mean, what it allows us to do, because as I said earlier, I mean, our scenes are very, in a sense, very static, the way we've chosen to treat them, the relationship with the audience. What happens between most scenes is that the camera moves.
Yeah.
And it kind of moves very fluidly around this kind of almost doll's house of a world, this globe, which, as you say, is incredibly theatrical. And all of those camera moves and all of the kind of technology that we had to use to sort of sew them together was mind-bendingly kind of complicated. And actually, I mean, to be brutally honest, when we did it in two shoots a year apart, and all of the actors and the performances were shot together in the first year. And then all the sort of background passes of people in the world were shot a year later. So sometimes, for example, there's as you probably know, there's a scene quite early on in an inn where Macbeth is, you know, sitting there and he's about to be told that he's staying at Cawdoran. And the five or six actors at the table were shot a year apart from everybody else in the inn.
Right.
You know, and which is, you know, in green screen, that itself is relatively easy. But then when the camera begins to move, obviously, and you need to tie up the stuff that you shot a year apart with the stuff you're shooting now, it becomes a technical, problem issue. And so we had some clever people who worked on that. And, you know, right up until the last minute, we weren't 100% convinced that this was going to work technically.
Well, in terms of personnel, a lot of CG work gets shipped overseas, doesn't it? So was that the case with this, or was this all British?
This is all completely British, absolutely. And actually, I think, in a sense, I mean, would have been almost impossible to do in a conventional visual effects house ways, because, you know, clearly, you know, normally a producer would go to a visual effects house and give them a list of shots, and the VFX house would do them, and this is so kind of built around an idea about how to use visual effects that kind of grew up. Basically, I mean, to cut a very long story short, what we did was we made a very experimental film called The Knife That Killed Me 4 years ago, which again was all green screen. And we made it with a bunch of graduates from a university up in York who'd all come out of the course. And they kind of grew up and you know, making this film grew up as in grew their talents, grew their understanding. And the film itself is quite uneven, but it's interesting. And I think there was enough in it that we made us think we wanted to try to sort of evolve that language. And subsequently, they and others who joined have become a kind of independent visual effects house doing absolutely conventional visual effects alongside this kind of slightly weird stuff like Macbeth, and are incredibly skilled and adept. But what they have, as I say, which is unusual, is a kind of creative attitude towards visual effects. And it's a small team. It's probably about 14 people. But, you know, they have a as I say, a sort of research and development mentality. So we are alongside all the kind of conventional sci-fi, you know, stuff that we're trying to make. We are always trying to experiment with new ideas about how to use visual effects in new ways.
It is visually stunning. It is. I think it. I mean, it probably needs at least two viewings.
It's interesting to say that. I mean, the number of people who said to me, that, you know, having seen it twice or even three times, that they get more out of it as they see it the other times. Absolutely. I think that is the case.
I think the soundscape is also. Obviously, it's one of those things that gets overlooked by a lot of people. But there is a sense of foreboding throughout.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, in a sense, I mean, some of that obviously is in Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. some of that is. I mean, I think we chose to use quite contemporary sound design. So that there's a lot of sort of low frequency rumbles and stuff that you wouldn't necessarily expect to be in a Shakespearean production. But then also there's a composer who we found as the modern world works. We found on the internet, called Gregory Spears, who's based in New York. I was kind of looking for a composer that felt, I mean, a bit like the play and the film itself. And what I want, I suppose, was something that absolutely acknowledged the play's 17th century heritage, that felt kind of it was of a period, but at the same time felt incredibly modern. And so just one slightly drunken evening, sitting in a tiny cottage just by the North York Moors, you know, googling away, came across this guy and went over to New York to meet him. And you know, he's written this I think really beautiful score, which, as I say, is a kind of really odd mixture of the contemporary and the 17th century. That along with the soundscape and this kind of bizarre theatrical computerized world, I think, you know, all give it a sort of sense of space and time that is, as I say, kind of has 17th century nods, but absolutely feels contemporary.
I think probably the thing that's most, well, it's not, there's a lot of sounding things about this movie. But I'm interested in you yourself as a director, because you mentioned this is your first movie.
It's the first film that I've directed on my own. Yeah.
Right.
The Knife That Killed Me, which was the previous one, was in collaboration with a guy, Marcus Romer, who kind of directed the performances, and I kind of was in charge of the visual language. And as I say, we were it was incredibly experimental, and we were sort of finding our way as we went. It was not entirely my first, but it's kind of the first one where I had the sort of total responsibility, I suppose.
Well, there's considerable ambition for a first movie. I mean, I know movie makers who they will go for something ambitious, but they will make it very short. Whereas obviously this is a 2-hour movie.
Yeah, I know. kind of had to answer that. I mean, yes, absolutely. I think, you know, I imagine you can sort of guess from having seen it that, you know, this isn't an attempt to sort of step into Hollywood. You know, I didn't make a film in order to sort of step up the directorial ladder. In a sense, it's I wouldn't say it's anti-film, but it's definitely trying to tread a slightly different path from the majority of films out there. And so I suppose, you know, I came at it with a very specific intention, and I think one of the things that The Knife That Killed Me had kind of proved, The Knife That Killed Me was basically, the conceit was it was about a teenager who was dead, and he's telling you the story from beyond the grave. So we were using green screen again in that in an unusual way to kind of theatricalize this sort of state of being that he was in, this sort of storytelling space. And as I say, it was uneven, but I felt there was stuff that we'd done that was really interesting and worth pursuing. And so the idea of taking on Shakespeare, which is in itself is quite scary, was simply because, as you pointed out right at the beginning of the conversation, you know, the kind of theatricality and the idea of Shakespearean language sort of all played into, I thought, a visual possibility that we could, you know, we could try and do something, you know, brave and bold. Mm. And so, yeah, it's 2 hours, and it's I think a piece which is full of intention. I mean, whether people respond to the intention or not, you know, I think it would be hard to look at it and go, they kind of made that film, but they didn't really know what they were trying to do. I think, you know, what we're trying to do is clear. And I'm, you know, that in a sense took a fairly lengthy project in order to be able to show that we kind of had, as I say, had a clear intention and were trying to wrestle with a specific set of problems.
Okay. I think watching it, I was, this is mainly for the listener, really, I think, if you're interested, I think I was mostly brought to mind of three other productions of Shakespeare that I've seen. One was Olivier's Henry V. The other one was Greenaway's Prospero. And the third one was an RSC tour of Romeo and Juliet from about 25 years ago. Which was very little stage dressing. And I think there's elements in your movie which that we've mentioned, the stage scenes that sort of evoke that. But it is very much as unique a movie as it's possible to get, I think, without being alienating.
Good. Well, I'm pleased. I mean, I wasn't intentionally setting out to make a unique film, but as I say, I think we all, and you know, as you know, filmmaking is usually collaborative. We all set out with an idea about, you know, what we intended to do, which was to try to make a film that used, you know, these very new technologies to try to re-explore a part of filmmaking that, you know, I feel that filmmakers have sort of abandoned over the last 50 years or so, largely, apart from some of the examples you've given. And you know, that is that idea that, you know, I mean, I remember watching Henry V, probably a good example, but there are lots of films from the sort of certainly earlier, the 30s and 40s and 50s, that are unapologetically theatrical. Yeah, they're shot in studios or wherever, and they sit in front of the audience and say, look, this is the story, you know, we're telling you a story, you know, it's a story, we know it's a story, let's just, you know, let's enjoy it, which is the contract you have when you go into a theater. You kind of go, let's this space can become enchanted if we all agree that it can be whatever it needs to be. And you know, latterly film has increasingly moved away from that and decided that its job is to create a perfectly finished material reality, you know, that you all stare at, and it does it brilliantly well. So I'm not absolutely not kind of having a go, but in doing that, it does lose some of that charm sometimes of the, you know, the co-creation that we all know you get in a good piece of theatre. And I think this was an attempt to see if, you know, by playing with some new technologies and going back in time to some fairly acknowledged theatrical territory, if you could kind of create something that felt new and vital, and but was exploring that very age-old relationship between, you know, an audience's imagination and a stimulus, and in this case the stimulus is a screen rather than a piece of theatre. And so there, that was the intention, and I'm, you know, I'm like everything you make, you know, there's always at the end of it you kind of have all the spurs that make you think, oh, you know, I could do that differently, or that could be done better, or, you know, whatever. But actually, I'm incredibly proud of, you know, of what we set out to try to do.
Yeah, good. Yeah, it is stunning. Just one last thing, I think, really, is where can we watch Macbeth?
Okay, well, it's on Monday, April 23rd. It will be released on iTunes and Amazon and Sky and and on other digital platforms. I haven't got the full list right in front of me, but it will be on. We have a website which is www.macbeththefilm.co.uk, and there's a link from there to purchase.
Excellent. There'll be full links in the show notes for this podcast. Kit Monkman, thank you very much for taking the time to speak to Bjorn Kasturbus. It's been absolutely fascinating, and the very best of luck with Macbeth.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Many thanks to Kit Monkman for joining us on this special Bjorn Kasturbus podcast, and also a big thanks to Strike Media. We'll be back with a new podcast soon. Until then, it's goodbye.